Welcome to Paddling Adventures Radio. I'm Sean Rowley, and with me is Derek Specht.
Hello.
How's it going, Derek?
Fantastic.
Busy week?
It's always busy.
Busy.
I've got my job, and I'm covering for a guy who's covering for another guy who's off for hip surgery, and
so many, is spring like hip knee surgery time? I know about four people that have been going through hip knee surgery lately.
Well, I think it's just the time of year when people would schedule it.
The most wonderful time of the year.
Because it's post-winter, and it's not quite summer, so summer vacation period hasn't started. So right about now is a good time to schedule a hip surgery, because you're going to be off for God knows how long. This guy's been off for 8 weeks so far.
See, that's something you want to do in winter, so you're not out walking. And it gives you
need to be walking.
Walk around the house.
You heal fat. This is what I'm hearing, is you need the little micro tears and whatever. So the thing that they jam into your thigh bone needs to be worked. You need a walk to make the bone seal around the prosthesis or the big metal thing that they jam in there.
So my dad was ahead of his time then.
Was he?
Because whenever we hurt ourselves, he would tell us to walk it off.
Walk it off.
Walk it off. They knew. Back in the 70s, well, people knew.
Yes, and it's been proven that you heal quicker if you stay mobile.
Yeah.
I think that's what happens with a lot of elderly people who fall and break their hip. They stop being mobile, and then it's deterioration downhill from there, right?
Yeah.
So if you can get, if you have a parent, grandparent that hurts themselves like that, get them up and moving.
Well, we got my mother-in-law, Walker, and she's boogieing all over the place now.
Yeah.
She had that last August? No, July, I think.
Broke something?
Yeah, broke her hip. But yeah, we saw her on the weekend there, and she was just boogieing all over the place.
Nice.
Yeah.
There you go. You got to get moving. Got to keep moving.
Right? Awesome. So other than that, nothing doing on this weekend other than hanging out, doing yard work. I know you were doing that.
Yes, yes. Over the weekend, yeah. Did some yard work. I'm very tired from that. I'm still recovering.
Get out and move.
Yes.
Get out and move.
Yes, yes. I try and walk around as much as I can.
Yeah.
Good thing I have a sit-stand desk at work.
How do you like those?
I like it a lot. It's it gives me different, instead of sitting all day, what they call it? I can't remember what they call it, but it's like they call it a disease, sitting disease or something. I can't remember what they call it, but it's just from sitting all day at your
flat
desk.
Flat ass disease?
You just, yes. So it's not healthy just to sit there all day. You got to get around and move around. I thought about getting one of those little office treadmills.
You can just use your stand and it was in front of your computer and like walk.
Constantly walk, yeah. Sit there, walk at your desk on it's a little mini treadmill that you can get. Or elliptical. I looked them up a couple years ago, ellipticals, treadmills, and stuff like that. But then I thought, man, I'm going to look like a real knob on a treadmill at my desk.
You mean more than normal.
More than normal, yeah.
Yeah, he's got that sit-stand desk and a treadmill, and he's doing his work. What a nerd!
There's a couple of us at work. We thought, you know, because the elliptical machine is just basically a pedal machine that sits under your chair type thing. So I thought, well, because me and a woman at work, we were both looking at, okay, well, I'll buy one, you buy the other, we'll switch off. But then the more I thought about it, I was like, I'm going to look like a complete idiot at work. Somebody's going to walk
the
by.
The cool kids are going to take you back and beat you up at lunch hour.
So I go
give us your lunch money, nerd.
when it's not busy, which is rare, but when it's not busy, I go for a walk outside at lunch.
Yeah.
And when it's not winter, because,
Well, you know what? Like, I park at the far end of our park. It's not a massive parking lot, but I take the spot farthest away from the door.
Yeah.
Because that's my, I'm getting that extra little walk.
There you go.
I could probably throw a ball and hit the building. But still.
Yeah.
It's the thought that counts. That donut I'm carrying into work, I'm burning that off. Oh, yeah. Yeah, getting out for more paddles soon. And it's busy. A lot of stuff coming up, so. But a lot of summer stuff, and we got a couple of trees to take down. I got to lawn all of a sudden is just taken right off. Everybody's been mowing this past weekend except for this guy.
We were going to let our grass go because we were. It's good for the bugs and whatever in the spring, right? And so we're in the backyard. We're not doing anything with the leaves until like June, but because of the bugs and whatever. But in the front yard, I was going to let it go, but like on Sunday, everywhere I heard like lawnmowers running everywhere in my neighborhood. It's like, am I going to be the only idiot with a long lawn?
Well, see, we got these. Tracy had planted these grape hyacinths.
Okay.
They're just little mini. They look like bunches of grapes, but upside down.
It's the purple things on your lawn.
The purple things.
Yeah, those are nice. Yeah.
And she planted them up near the garden.
Mm-hmm. They spread far.
And they've gone like, what, a quarter, almost halfway down our lawn. So I mow our lawn except for where they start.
Yeah.
So half our front lawn is mowed.
Yeah.
The other half is purple with long, nice green grass.
Oh, okay.
And it's like, that looks pretty comfy. Like, that'd be, like, you'd want to lay in that.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Except, you know, the birds hit the bird bath and poop all over the place. But it's under the tree, then everything falls out of the tree. But still, it's pretty cool. And then the backyard, we just mow because it's easier to scoop.
Yeah, yeah.
It's easier to scoop the dog poop from mowing the grass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Trying to
find it from 6-inch
six,
tall
eight
grass.
Inch tall grass, and you're pulling the poop out, and you're trying to pull it, and it's sticking some of the grass.
Yeah, the good old days. It's when you just flip it over the neighbor's yard.
Exactly.
Yeah, they're like... two or three of the neighbors now have dogs around us. So if one happened to flip over the fence,
they wouldn't know.
They wouldn't know if it was their dogs or my dogs.
We've got an outdoor trail near work, and I don't know what it is. It'd be 2 kilometers, 2.2 or something. It's quite a long trail. Anyways, you walk along that trail, and somebody has bagged their dog poo. So you have these purple bags, and then they whip it into the woods, and you can see it hanging from branches. It's like, why bag
bother?
It? Yeah. Why bag it? Why not just flick it into the woods?
See, some of the dog trails we go to, people are like, oh, my dog pooped. I will use my bright green poo bag and tie it up, and I'll place it beside this tree because we're coming back this way.
And then they don't come
back. And then they don't come back that way, or they don't pick it up on the way back, or... Oy. Anyway.
Bad people. Bad, bad.
Bad people.
Be responsible.
Yeah. Tell your dog to go way off in the woods and poop. Poop with the rest of the coyotes. Oh, it's good time. So, you know, I told you I had got the harness.
Yes.
I never did show you the footage of Athena with the GoPro on.
Mm-hmm.
Ripping through the woods after that other dog.
Oh, okay.
The two of them were just... full tilt running through the woods. And she had the one on the chest was like bouncy all over, but the one on the back actually got some good footage of her ripping through the woods. I'm surprised it didn't get knocked off or busted or something. But
I'm having flashbacks of, hey, I went on vacation. You want to see 1,200 photos? No.
1,199? Who wants to go for a slideshow? Oh, yay.
Have you had the camera facing backwards to see?
That's going to be the next thing.
Okay.
Is we're going to put it facing backwards so that she can basically where she's been. So you you're gonna get footage of her butt and her tail
picture
running. Butt
or a picture of you chasing her. Come back!
Or another dog chasing.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you're throw the old GoPros on, and same with on when you get them on your head or your canoe, get them home and check out the footage. So there's this woman, Megan Gilbert. Her and her husband set out on what they thought would be an uneventful kayaking trip, Cape Town, South Africa. And as they were paddling around, they were surprised to spot a couple of jellyfish, which one does? When we started kayaking, we were really excited because we noticed one or two, Gilbert says. Then we started seeing a few more. Then we ran into whole patches of them. As Gilbert kept seeing more and more jellyfish, she thought to herself, they look like they go down forever. Curious to find out just how many there were beneath the waves, Gilbert decided to stick her GoPro into the water and record. She plunged her hand into the water, praying she wouldn't get stung. Luckily, she managed to record a few seconds of footage without getting injured. Hours later, when Gilbert returned home, she checked to see what her GoPro had captured and was shocked by what she saw. Turns out the whole time she'd been kayaking just inches above thousands of jellyfish. When I finally checked the footage, I almost had a heart attack, Gilbert said. I was shocked. Gilbert confirmed that the species she'd encountered are called nightlight jellyfish, also known as mauve stingers. And with the word stinger in its name, I don't want to be part of.
It tells you a little bit.
Yeah. They're bioluminescent invertebrates who glow in the dark and when waves hit them.
Very cool.
Because nightlight jellyfish have limited swimming ability, they often stick together in large groups known as blooms, like the one Gilbert encountered. As the wind pushes the blooms around, an area can go years without seeing nightlight jellyfish, then suddenly see thousands of them all at once. Over the past few months, the waters surrounding Cape Town have been taken over by nightlight jellies. Gilbert feels lucky she happened to stumble upon the jellyfish bloom during a brief period, that it'll stay in the area. It's both beautiful and scary at the same time, she says. You never know what the ocean will have for you. It's magical. So there is a video of it, and there is a ton.
There is.
There's a, yeah. Like,
I went on Instagram and I found her page, and it was like, it's incredible. And I've never seen it from underwater, like in large blooms of them. I've seen scuba diving some jellyfish.
Yeah, you see one
or
two.
You stay away.
Yeah.
But I've seen them from, I think it was in Halifax, I saw some blooms of purple jellyfish. And I've never seen it underwater. It was really cool to see them stratified everywhere.
If you knew it was like that, that's when you'd put it on a stick or something.
I know.
Put it down lower and just like...
If she'd only known, she could have like just...
She got some good footage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you imagine?
So if you go to Instagram or TikTok, check out Megan, M-E-G-A-N, the travel writer. Go to her pages there on Instagram or TikTok, and you'll be able to, it's not a massively long, it's only like 5 seconds, 10 seconds,
and it's only like 8 or so posts back, so you don't have to scroll far to find it.
No. But just take a peek at how many jellyfish there
are.
It's
amazing.
That was definitely something. But that's like I say, when you get the GoPros on and stuff like that, you don't really know what you're seeing. And mind you, my GoPros that I have now hook up to my phone.
Oh, yeah.
So I can use my phone as a monitor. But when I hit record, I don't know what I'm recording.
Yeah.
But when I turn record off, I can see what I'm looking at, which be pretty cool to be able to, ooh, that's what's underneath me
exactly,
right now.
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
See the shark coming.
Right, and to grab my hand. That'd be awesome. Hey, look, there's the inside of his mouth. How about that? Again, Megan, the travel writer on Instagram, TikTok, and check out the jellyfish bloom that they found. Speaking of lighting up, Light Up the Night Kayaking is back for 2025, with 7 nights happening in Stratford, Ontario, and another 2 taking place in St. Mary's. David Price is a co-organizer and says the fun started in 2021 thanks to a local kayaking enthusiast. Now, we did the Lock and Paddle at Night the 1 year. Were you there for that year?
No.
No. You light up your your canoes and kayaks and all that with lights and everything, and then you go out on the water with a whole group of people.
It'll be very
pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, Sue Clark brought Light Up the Night Kayaking to Stratford as her passion for kayaking was greater than the hours in a day. From there, it has become a piece of Stratford, Price says. Light Up the Night continues to be an exciting part of the summer for many kayakers as well as the people and visitors of Stratford. Participants get creative by decorating their kayaks, paddleboards, or canoes with lights before gathering at the river, which is pretty cool to see.
Yeah. I've seen pictures of it, and I think Alan posted some pictures once of his kayak lit up and stuff when he did the Toronto Islands. And
yeah.
It looks pretty cool.
Yeah. I've been down there with Alan at night once, and we put the lights front and back sort of thing.
Oh, the nav lights.
The nav lights. Yeah. But, yeah, there's people that just totally light up their entire boat, right? People can expect an amazing night, whether on the water or the shore. As the sun goes down, we come out and light up the night with everyone's creativity. You can also expect to meet tons of new people. We have paddlers come far away as North Bay for these events, so there are many new friends to make and also opportunities to learn about different places in Ontario to kayak. With excitement building, organizers have announced this year's schedule and themes. In Stratford, the dates and themes include May 24th, Wild Wild West. So you decorate your boat and dress up in costumes. June 28th, Canada Day. July 26th, Christmas in July. August 16th, Superhero. September 20th, PJ Paddle. So in your PJs.
Oh, okay.
In your PJs, your pajamas.
The first thing coming to mind is PJ Justice. Yeah, and it's like, hey, yeah, wait, are we going to dress up like PJ?
Yeah. We're all going to be friends at Tamagami that day. October 18th, Lantern Paddle. October 25th, Halloween. Two events in St. Mary's will include June 7th, which is Hawaiian, and July 12th, Flower Power.
It's spread out throughout the whole summer. That's nice.
Yeah. All the way up to Halloween.
Yeah. Each month is captured.
This year, as usual, we are adding a few new themes, Price said, kicking off the season with a Wild Wild West theme. Participants can dress up and decorate their kayak accordingly and use an unlimited amount of creativity to share with everyone. Additionally, we are doing a PJ paddle later in the season where people can show up in their onesies, PJs, or comfy clothes and paddle the river before bed.
Huh.
And Derek sleeps in the nude.
Oh, jeez.
He's going to have his kayak skirt on that night. Light Up the Night kayaking is a hit with the community, with larger numbers joining in on the fun when the water is much warmer in the summer months. Plus, as well, I mean, as summer hits its stride, you get longer hours of light.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Right? Summer events are the most popular, seeing up to 200 paddlers on the water, as well as hundreds on the shore along the river and on the island enjoying the kayaks floating down the river. We kayak to Halloween in October, so the later events don't see as many kayaks on the water, but what we lack in numbers we make up for in our creativity. The later themes, such as Halloween, provide ample opportunity for decoration ideas. Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
There's no cost to participate if you own a watercraft. The only cost is how much participants choose to spend on decorations. Wait, Canada Day. Oh.
What?
Just lace your boat with fireworks.
My canoe's on fire. My kayak's on fire.
Just fireworks galore going on. Those, what are the Super 8 Ball ones? Roman candles.
Oh, okay.
Oh, just Roman. Just time them one right after the other. It'd just be nonstop Roman candle balls flying off into the night. That'd be awesome. Yeah. So, yeah, that's whatever you choose to spend on decorations is what it's going to cost you.
Yeah.
For anyone who does not have a watercraft, the boathouse will be staying open late for rentals. Only prerequisite for participation is to be safe and have fun. Oh.
I would have been able to have fun.
Well, the safe part. How sticky are you on that?
Safety third.
Safety third, baby. We ask that if you were joining in on the fun on the water, that you come prepared with adequate lighting, your life jacket, and safety kit. This allows everyone to have a safe and exciting experience.
Where's Stratford? That's down by Welland or something, or is that?
No, Port that's
Dalhousie.
Or Port Stratford? Dalhousie? That's towards Guelph Kitchener, is it not?
Is it?
Yeah, Waterloo Way.
Keep going. I'm going to look it up.
Are you Googling it?
I am.
Are you Googling it?
Yeah. But don't wake me. I'm going to.
We're waiting for Derek again.
No, don't wait for Derek.
Oh, good Lord. That's all we ever do is wait for Derek. Oh, because he asks these questions that.
It was a Stratford in New Zealand. Where's the water? Oh, there's a
Stratford, Ontario.
There's a large, long lake thing.
Are you looking at Stratford, Ontario?
I am. It is near. It is east of Grand Bend, southeast of Goderich.
Is it that far up?
It is northeast of Sarnia.
Oh, yeah. It's past Kitchener.
Past Kitchener. Yeah. Between Sarnia and Kitchener, sort of. Closer to Kitchener. Very close to. And there's water there. Because isn't there Stratford
Festival.
Outdoor Festival, like live plays?
Shakespeare Guardians.
Shakespeare.
The Shakespearean Gardens are there.
Yeah.
Stratford
Festival.
The Stratford Festival every year is there.
Hmm.
Yeah. So it's northeast of London, Ontario, and just west of Kitchener.
Yeah.
Yeah, I knew it was over that way somewhere.
Cool.
It's somewhere in Ontario. I knew that.
Yeah.
Tis the season where people are going to start with all their big trips. The big expeditions are starting out, and you just got to wait this time of year to start seeing who's doing what. There's Meanest Link groups already going. Yeah, I think I saw a story. There's a group heading out already to do the Meanest Link.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Pretty early in the season, but the water's going to be high.
Yeah. I saw the pictures. It's like, I saw someone comment is like, they look awfully clean.
For now. Because they haven't started yet. Just give them away. I wouldn't want to do the Meanest Link this early in the season.
This is really early. Yeah. I'm wondering if all the ice is out in the northern end of the park.
Guess they'll find out. Well, I guess if they're doing it, then people from Algonquin will tell them, yes, it's out.
Yeah. But I'm sure they got some.
Going to be awful cold in those rapids.
A lot of people do it in like the first week of June.
Mm-hmm.
First or second week. That's because you're still in the bug season. Like, I suppose at this point in the northern end of the park, you're not going to have a lot of bugs. But,
yeah, could you imagine waiting, though?
What?
Waiting.
Oh. Well, the key thing about doing it early is you have some high water to make it easier to traverse some of the areas.
But there's still going to be times you got to get out.
Oh, yeah.
Well, hopefully they got dry suits.
Yeah. Well, the Big East, that's going to be flowing pretty heavy at this time of year. So if they do the typical clockwise rotation, then it's a hard slog in high water up the Big East.
Da, da, da.
Hmm.
Better them than me. That's what I always say.
Yeah.
Anyway, so there's a few big expeditions and trips and smaller expeditions and trips and whatnot starting. But this is the season where they all start being made public.
Yes.
So, that being said, there's always the typical somebody's going across Canada.
Oh, yes.
Right? Every couple of years, it's always, somebody's going across Canada again for this, that, and whatnot, which is always cool to follow along. But there's this fella.
Fella?
There's a fella, Kyle Parker. He hiked out to the tip of Cape Flattery in Washington State, marking the northwestern point of his journey across the United States. May 1st, he slid his canoe into Nia Bay and started paddling east. Everything goes as planned for the 24-year-old. He'll be lying on the beaches of Miami, Florida in 6 to 8 months.
Oh. Well, he's going the right direction for it. So he's going to be the northern part for the most of the spring, summer.
Mm-hmm.
By the time winter comes back around again, he'll be down towards Florida. So
May, June, July, August, September, October, November. Could be December. Perfect time. Perfect way to do it. Parker got into paddling during college, working as an outfitter in the Boundary Waters Canoe Wilderness area of Minnesota. After graduation, he started training to beat the record for fastest time solo canoeing on the Wisconsin River, which he accomplished in September 2024 with 5 days, 19 hours, and 54-minute trip. After taking the record for the Wisconsin River, Parker started brainstorming on what he could do next. Eventually, I was like, why don't I just see how far I can go? Log the biggest route I can find and go for it, he said. Well, that works.
Yeah, yeah.
So he came up with his next adventure, which he dubbed Tip to Tip. His planned route takes him from Nia Bay into Puget Sound and then Possession Sound, where he'll then start canoeing up the Skykomish River. He'll have to hike some of the way, portaging his canoe over Stevens Pass until he hits the Columbia River. He'll take the Columbia River as far as he can until he has to portage through Spokane to get to the Clark Fork River, which he'll take down to Missoula, Montana. When he reaches Montana, he'll then carry his canoe roughly 150 miles. Okay, you had me up until then. to Helena, Montana, where he can get to the Missouri River. From there, he'll paddle the rest of the way through Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, and Missouri until he reaches the Mississippi River in St. Louis. See, now, if I'm doing something like this, I am putting in the caveat that I am not necessarily doing the walking bits. So if anybody's along the route wants to come and give me a little bit of a lift on that 150 miles, who am I to deny them the opportunity to pitch in? I'm paddling across. I'm not walking. I'm just saying. If I ever put one of these down on paper that I'm going to do it, just be aware I am not portaging that far. The Mississippi will take him the rest of the way to the Gulf of Mexico, his final stretch to paddle around the tip of Florida to Miami. Well, if you're in Miami and you're paddling, you might as well just keep on going to Cuba. I mean, why? It's not that far. It's so cool to be able to connect as many different environments as you can, he said. You have everything from the mountains and the coniferous forests, the plains, the swamps, and the ocean. Parker regularly posts on his Instagram at parker.paddles and his blog parkerpaddles.com. He writes updates on his journeys, lays out the gear he uses and sponsorship he's part of, and shares the motivation behind his canoeing adventures. So if you want to learn, you know, you're thinking about doing something like this, go check those out, parkerpaddles.com or at parker.paddles, and see what he's using for gear and how he lays things out. It's about pushing myself, embracing new experiences, and connecting with both the places I visit and the people I meet along the way. He says that in his post for the Tip to Tip trip. I want to connect with locals, hear their stories, and experience the culture of each place I visit. And that's what everybody says that does these big trips.
Mm-hmm.
Big trips. Didn't sound right.
It works.
Yeah. They always talk about, it's not just about the trip and seeing the scenery, but it's the people you meet along the way. Mm-hmm. And that's not just paddle related either. You talk about all the people doing these cross Canada or cross country hiking trails and that, right?
Yeah.
They say the same thing. It's the people you meet along the way.
Exactly. And like you don't want it to take too long, but you also need to stop and smell the flowers, right? So that, I think that could be, like for me, I would get so distracted. Oh, I want to see this. I want to see that. And then it's like, oh, this is an 18-month trip now.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. Like, if you could do one, take like the summer off.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, like, I mean, May, June, July, August, September, October the most. So 6 months most would be cool.
Yeah.
But when you start getting into December, January, February, you better be down the southern sides by
then.
I
know, right?
Right? Yeah. Because at that point, it's like, do I really want to be doing this in ice?
Yeah.
And being who knows? Speaking of long trips and ice.
But speaking of long trips, I've been following lately Peter Frank. I saw a post this week. He said he was looking for some support. And in the end, he said, you know what? Never mind. I'm not going to do that. But he was looking for somebody who could help escort him. He needed a safety person or backup because he was doing Lake Okeechobee in southern.
Who is this?
Peter Frank.
I thought you said Frank Wolf for a second.
No.
Because he's doing a trip as well right now.
Oh, yes, he is. I saw that.
Sorry. Yeah, so, yeah, Peter Frank was looking for the Okeechobee.
He's doing the Okeechobee, and he says, well, it's crocodile mating season or how
they, gators.
It's gator mating season, and they're a little aggressive. So he was looking for help. Somebody could motor along beside him while he paddled. He just needed somebody there. But then he decided, you know what? All that's going to happen is they're going to watch me being eaten. So, why am I doing this? So he's doing a 38-mile portage.
Yeah.
To get through on the other side of Lake Okeechobee in Florida. And he's got to avoid the alligators.
Yeah. And there was a woman that was in Florida.
Yeah.
A gator hit her.
Oh.
Boat tipped her out.
Yep.
Yeah. Her husband tried to help, but.
Yeah. It's that season. Yeah.
It's that season, yeah.
It's like in the fall up in Algonquin. It's like, yeah, stay away from the moose. They're a
rutting
little
season.
Rutting season. They're a little dangerous. They get a little crazy. And
I don't think it's a good kick with one of their
toes. So he's now crossing the Florida Panhandle through Okeechobee, and he's going to be working his way back up the west coast of Florida. And so he's got to be about halfway. I don't know what the halfway point is. But,
yeah, I just know he's making quite a ways. Yeah, he's got to be just over halfway now.
Yeah. So it's neat to follow him along now. At first, I had to make the conscious effort to go to his website, which I always forgot. But now it just pops up on my Instagram feed. Right? And so he's always there. I see the post every day. He posts a picture, a little short video clip every single day on Instagram. So it's really interesting to see him in his pirate regalia and making his way on his... In his canoe.
Yeah.
So, very cool.
Speaking of canoes, Christchurch, down in New Zealand.
Yes.
Where is the Waimari Surf Life Saving Club's radical surf canoe from the 1960s? Club is appealing for help finding an important part of their heritage. And the only reason I'm talking about this is because I'm surprised at how many people we have that listen to us from Australia, New Zealand, down there. We get people talking to us all the time from there. The club is appealing for help in finding an important part of its heritage.
They like listening to our lack of accent.
Probably. Waimari has a strong tradition in surf canoe racing with numerous national championship titles over the years. And it all kicked off by the invention of a new cutting-edge surf canoe in the mid-60s. Now, this is the problem with podcasts, is I can't show you the picture of this thing.
Yeah, I know.
It's pretty neat with the jellyfish, I'd be able
to show you.
Former club member and historian John Brock said the canoe crew at the time wanted to leap ahead of their competition, who were using rigid fiberglass vessels. A new racing canoe was designed and built following sponsorship from the Christchurch Star in 1965. I wasn't even born yet. It featured a canvas-covered single-hull wooden frame with a turned-up bow designed to bend as it cut through the waves. Canoe's 5-year domination at the national championships in the 60s and 70s established Waimari as a club to beat. However, by the mid-1970s, the canoe was superseded by newer, faster craft equipped with rudders to assist steering. That's cheating. It then disappeared into obscurity. Brock said the Christchurch Star canoe was one of the most radically designed surf canoes of its time. However, no one at the club can recall what happened to it. Said the club is keen to solve the mystery of the canoe's disappearance and recover an important piece of its history. It's probably a long shot after all those years, but worth a try. We would really welcome knowing the answer to the canoe's vanishing mystery, if it still exists, and if so, in what capacity. If you have information about the canoe, email John Brock at john.mcleod.brock@gmail.com. I'm sure if you go to the Waimari Surf Lifesaving Club sites, you can find them there as well. But yeah, looking for this boat from the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And 1965. But yeah, you look at this thing and it's like, that's quite the...
It surprises me that they lost track of it. Like, because if you had something that was that core to a string of victories, a string of race victories,
mm-hmm.
you think you keep it on hand.
That could have been, you know what, they put it up on rafters or something,
mm-hmm.
or and then somebody borrowed it and
kept it, and it's in somebody else's, like...
Somebody else used it, yeah. somebody else used it, somebody else...
Hanging off somebody's ceiling.
Yeah, it could be hanging off somebody's... It could be... So, you know what, we'll store that for you in our barn. Right? Like, how many times have you hear the stories here about finding old cars in barns because somebody stored it there and forgot it was there?
Yeah.
Or passed away and forgot to...
Yeah.
No one knew...
Barn find.
...that it was there, yeah. So it could just be sitting in somebody's boathouse
mm-hmm.
collecting dust and no one really knew where it came from. And now they'll go, wait a minute, we're listening to a podcast. I betcha.
I know where that is.
Those Canadians we're talking about.
It reminds me of... I had a older sailboat. It was a 1976 Northern Quarter Ton built in Ajax, Ontario. And it, at the time of its hull design, it was one of the fastest ones. It won a lot of regattas. So the boat that I had, it had a brass plaque inside, and it had like five or six wins in the mid to late 70s. And eventually, new technology, new whatever, and it's got surpassed. And then it sat for a few years when I got it. I sailed it for a few years. Then I sat in my backyard. It's like, it's got to go. So I took a Sawzall and chopped this sucker up. And so it had a racing history to it. It was one of the first designs of the Northern Quarter Ton built out of Ajax. And I chopped it up into pieces, put it in a dumpster, dragged the lead keel to the metal recycling, got like $800 for that. And
race its way right into the recycling.
People don't really, including me, people don't really, nobody wants to keep some of these things around. But
especially that size.
Yes. But a canoe, you'd think you'd keep a canoe.
Mm-hmm.
Stick it on.
It was a bigger racing canoe, too.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Stick it above your fireplace.
This wouldn't fit above the fireplace. But I got to think it's probably sitting in somebody's boathouse if
it's got to be sitting somewhere. Probably. Does it say how big it was?
No. Like I say, the only thing I saw was the picture of like five people carrying it.
Yeah.
Right? It seems like they got out of the water from paddling
because
there's big surf.
Yeah.
And it's upside down and they're carrying it.
Probably to
wherever they rest it, right? But it looked like a big, pretty sleek looking boat. But I'm just interested in the part where it says that it was designed to bend as it cut through the waves.
That keeps grabbing my mind too. It's like, well, what do you mean?
My boat's bending. I don't want to be in that boat no more.
It's designed to bend. I don't know if I trust that.
It folds in half. It's designed to do that.
It's the original Oru.
Yeah, weird, but hey. There is another expedition.
A
bit different, bit the same, bit different.
If I could only get the time off.
The 2026 Northwest Passage Arctic Outrigger Expedition. Dun, dun, dun. So information for this one up there says, we are going to paddle in reverse the expedition route from 2023 when we completed the first ever human-powered navigation of the entire Northwest Passage. Led by West Hansen and Jeff Wiesty, the team of 8 to 10 paddlers will depart near Tuktoyaktuk, Northwest Territories, as soon as the ice breaks and head east through the Northwest Passage and end near Pond Inlet in Baffin Bay. Approximately 1,800 miles, expedition will be self-supported with resupply stops at towns throughout the first half of the route. So this is West and Jeff, and them did it in 2023. And was successful, first human-powered in one season. They're going to do it the other way.
Do it the opposite way. Yeah.
Yep, do it the opposite way. And there's a couple changes they're going to do, but they've put this out as, hey, here, if you're interested. The Western approach has been attempted several times by rowers and kayakers. However, no one has successfully completed the entire Northwest Passage from this direction. Now, we've had conversations about this before. Doing it that way, you're racing time to beat
Yes.
The weather, the winter.
Because you're heading north.
Yeah. You're heading into the ice as opposed to the ice chasing you down to Tuktoyaktuk.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to make a big difference.
But I think what they're doing is with the change in watercraft and the number of people and the number of people in each watercraft, it makes sense that they could – it's going to be faster. They can be faster.
Definitely.
You're still at the mercy of bad weather and floating icebergs and you know,
ice
stuff
up
like that.
Ice up,
exactly. But, yeah, it's
Mother Nature will dictate whether you make it or not.
Exactly.
So requirements, if you are interested. Potential teammates will need to show via tracking apps the ability to paddle 40 miles in a 10 to 12 hour period in open water on several outings. Example, not just a single example, either in a canoe or solo tandem sea kayak. So you got to show multiple trips.
Mm-hmm.
The requirement can be substituted with a resume that includes well-documented open ocean multi-day expeditions with timelines. Those with little or no experience are welcome and should start a training program in order to assure they can meet the basic paddling requirements for the expedition, Derek. Team members consistently unable to maintain the team pace will be dismissed at the next settlement. Derek.
You're voted back onto the island.
You are voted out of the boat and onto the island, Derek. If at all possible, we'd welcome interested teammates to come to Texas for some one-on-one training. Strong sense of humor and ability to get along with difficult conditions is essential. People with medical conditions exacerbated by cold temperatures should not apply. This is not a catered event. What?
Definitely not.
Everyone is expected to work and contribute towards the team effort. Included OC6 outrigger canoes.
So this
That's
is
different.
Yeah, so these are typical racing canoes. If you see when you see anything with racing in the Olympics, they have OC1s and OC2s so this one here is a six-seater.
Mm-hmm.
It's got an outrigger, something that you typically see if you watched like open ocean Hawaiian racing and stuff.
Mm-hmm. So they're doing the OC6 outrigger canoes, tents, sleeping bags, sleeping pads, stoves, food, water, dromedaries, which is nice to bring in Arctic camels, dry suits, underlayers. Arctic camels are a favorite food of polar bears.
Yes.
A rarely known fact. Footwear, skirts, paddles, camp gear, charts, VHF radios, rescue, evac insurance coverage, Starlink, which is limited. Personal emergency locator beacons, PFDs, GPS units, dry bags, camping permits, firearms and permits, bear alarms, shipping, flare guns, first aid kits, pee bottles, repair material. The pee bottles left us on a whole rabbit hole tangent before the show. We will not submit you to that. Repair material, water bottles, biodegradable, personal hygiene wipes. Charger bricks, wind-powered chargers, and mess kits. This is not a complete list, so please feel free to question additional items which are included. Dietary preferences can be taken into account and accommodated on an individual basis with plenty of notice. It's a lot of stuff they're including in on this that you don't need to bring. Not included.
But you know why, and we talked about this earlier too, yeah. It makes sense that they're saying what is included because it gives West and Jeff a little bit of control over certain elements of the gear setup.
You don't want somebody showing up with a subpar sleeping bag.
Exactly. Yeah. Somebody shows up, they don't know what they're, it's like, no, these are the sleeping pads we use. We know them. We trust them. These are the bags we use. We know them. We trust them. You know what I mean? And it's smart. It's very smart. They're exercising control over the equipment that individuals are going to use.
Well, it eliminates any possibilities of someone being ill-equipped for something.
Yeah.
And
oh, I decided I didn't need that.
Yeah, if somebody's ill-equipped and all of a sudden they got to drop that person off,
yeah.
They're down a team member.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is a very smart way to do this. Not included, camp clothing, a list will be provided. Travel to Inuvik and and from Pond Inlet or other towns of departure from the expedition, hotel rooms, meals during town visits, travel within towns, personal sat phones, personal hygiene items. A list of personal clothing and other optional items will be provided. So I guess we're not sharing toothbrushes, huh? Progress can and will be sporadic throughout the entire expedition, with many days spent on the shore awaiting optimal and safe paddling conditions. Safety is the priority for the team, and unsafe behaviors will be cause for dismissal, as will be any behaviors detrimental to individual team members or the group.
Oh, you skipped the big word.
I'm not using that word. I refuse to use that word. firearms will be provided, and each member will be required to complete a firearms registration certificate with the Canadian government and adhere to all laws and regulations with priority given to Nunavut government and the Inuit authority over their sovereign territory. That's very important how he's worded that.
Yes.
Each member will be given instruction on firearm safety and use prior to launch. The completion of this expedition is not guaranteed. Variables depending on many factors, known and unknown. Some of the known factors include the presence of fast ice and sea ice, weather conditions, layover, zero progress days, and team/individual issues. Refunds are available under certain circumstances well before launch, but not after launch. Sounds fun. I had the time and money.
So it's
and the
it's
training.
I think it's one of those, you know, the three types of fun type thing. So I think this is, it's going to be challenging. It's going to be hard. It's going to be difficult. There's going to be lots of challenges. Your inclement weather, cold water, the risk of injury is crazy. Polar bears, like there's a lot of risks involved.
I heard that going up and petting a polar bear on any of Wes Hansen's northern trips is a no-no. So, he does not allow you to do it. So there's no petting of the polar bears.
Where's the line about, oh, any behaviors detrimental to the individual team members or the milieu of the group? Yes, no petting of the polar bears. Don't make friends. We're not here to make friends.
Sorry, Wes, can't make it on your trip.
Looks like friend. Why not friend?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
If they're not friendly, then why do they make them all fluffy and cuddly looking? like you say, the three types of fun.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be hard to do. At the end of the day, you're probably going to, you know, be looking back at the day's progress. If it was a hard day and not be enjoying yourself. But then at the end of the trip,
this is an amazing memory.
Remember the time that polar bear chased Derek when he's trying to take a... That was hilarious. To us, not necessarily to Derek.
It would be, I think it would be challenging, but rewarding.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we followed them along the first trip.
So. Yeah. It was a lot of work. Like, what was it, 2022 was their failed expedition?
23 was their good one.
It was their good one. And they've been talking about launching another one. I thought they were going to do another one this year, but...
Yeah, I thought it was this year, but I think he's just getting ready for it.
Yeah.
Doing all the planning.
So this is 2026. You have a year, so it'll be July-ish. July? Because I know
I think they do it earlier.
They might start earlier because you're starting south. When they left Pond the first two times, they were had to start later in season because they needed the sea ice to clear.
Mm-hmm.
And they did get caught up a couple times in some sea ice flows and so on.
Because the wind blows it back into the
wind
shore,
blows
it
back in. It's not enough of it's melted because it hangs around until early to mid-July, right? So it makes sense to, they should be able to start earlier if they're coming out of Tuck and starting the journey maybe mid-June, early June. So.
Well, if you think that you'd be a good fit for this crew, send inquiries about individual costs and other details and resumes for consideration, then you can just go to westhanson.com and click on the contact tab and send him a message going, "Hey, West, buddy, pal, Sean and Derek sent me."
Yeah, yeah.
At which point, he will probably just shut you right down.
Oh, no, not from those guys. Not
those guys.
I don't trust their recommendation.
This guy gets a 5-star rating from us. Okay, into the trash his resume goes. Yeah, westhanson.com, and just send a message and say you're interested in going. Then he'll ask you questions and...
Yeah.
And if you're listening to this and you make it on the team, let us know.
Yes, I would like to hear back from people.
Mm-hmm. So that's going to be cool. So yeah, 2026. Tuck to Yak, Tuck to Pond Inlet. Woohoo!
It sounds like an awesome trip. I would honestly love to do it.
Our biggest question on this one was the OC6 outriggers.
Mm-hmm.
8 to 10 people. So, I mean, we're sitting there thinking, are they going to put 3 in each? And then, wait a minute, that doesn't add. So then 4 in each, but wait, then there's 5 in each for 2 of them?
Yeah.
Which would make the 10, or 4
in 2. Because you're going to have to store gear.
Because there's going to be all the gear and everything like that, yeah. Right?
So the OC6 means they hold 6 people. There's 6 seats, seating positions, so they could, any of the empty seats, there's storage in the bow and stern, plus mm-hmm. various other storage. Any empty seats they could put in.
But for 8 to 10 people, you got to have all that extra.
It's a lot of extra food.
Yeah. I'd be interested to see how many of these outriggers they're bringing and how many people.
Yeah.
And how they are going to store.
I'm curious, the logistics.
Yeah.
Because, like, they're going to be resupplying food, but otherwise the normal day-to-day items, like... tents and sleeping bags and and clothing and other necessary gear, first aid and all that stuff.
Gotta go somewhere.
It's going to have to be stored somewhere. And when you have like up to 10 people, that's a lot of gear.
Yeah. And maybe they'll be towing a trailer boat.
towing a raft.
Just tow a raft behind them.
I'm skeptical on that one.
Yeah.
But I was looking at a lot of the pictures, different OC6 designs. There seems to be a lot of storage in the bow and the stern. So I'm thinking, but do you remember looking at some of the photos of the fully loaded kayaks from the 2023 expedition?
Yeah.
Like they were piled high to the
sky.
That's
why I'm saying.
They look so top heavy.
And then you add a bunch more people in each boat with all the...
Exactly.
Each person is more gear.
I wonder how big the outrigger is. I wonder if they...
Maybe they have two outriggers with 5 people each and a third outrigger that's filled with gear.
Just a drag.
And the two two ones paddling tow it behind them.
we'll have to have a discussion with West and
find
ask him some, find out some details.
Yeah. Stay tuned.
Mm-hmm.
Saw this bit here and it kind of resonates, with me and my daughter. Paddleboard, paints, and the open sea aren't your usual studio setup, but for artist Anita Jasmine, it's all part of the creative process. Now the Sunderland, UK-based painter is preparing to unveil her first major solo exhibition, People, Places, and Paddling, at Art Center Washington later this month. Anita, who lives in Roker, creates much of her work while afloat on the North Sea. Originally working with a tin of paints before soggy disasters led her to switch to waterproof containers, she anchors her board to stay steady as she sketches and paints the changing coastal views. I used to drift a bit too much on the board, but now I take an anchor to keep me relatively still, she says. Sometimes I'll more or less finish the works at sea, while others I'll work on when I'm at home. So I say this kind of resonates because when my daughter and I would go on canoe trips, we've in the past taken her easel and paints and stuff like that.
There is one here.
That was from before that.
Oh.
The ones I got are, I think they're just down over here right now.
Because I've seen some of the ones she's painted on your trips.
Yeah, and So, yeah, so she used to paint stuff while you're sitting there on the beach. Yeah. And I would be up in the hammock or something having a snooze or reading, and she'd be down sitting in her chair with her easel set up. And it's one of those portable easels that fold all down into a case.
Mm-hmm.
And then with all her paints and brushes and extra stuff, canvases. And yeah, it's a bit to throw into the boat, but nothing big.
Yeah.
You know, so she used to do that. So when I saw this, I'm thinking, oh, so she's not the only one that does this sort of thing.
Yeah, it's popular.
Yeah. Anita's exhibition will feature around 80 works, from delicate watercolors and sketches to portraits and artworks made using driftwood, teabag tags, and even handwritten paper, tissue paper. The sea and memory are key themes in Anita's work, including a deeply personal portrait of her grandparents, colored using used teabag tags and their handwriting.
That's unusual.
Yeah. Originally from Middlesex, Anita moved to the Northeast to study fine art after being captivated by the world-famous Freddy the Dolphin. I never did look up who Freddy the Dolphin was. Decades later, she's never happier than spending time on her paddleboard with the pods of dolphins who regularly arrive between the Roker Piers and off the Wearside Coast.
Freddy the Dolphin, if he's worldwide famous, I've never heard of him.
Maybe he's a dolphin that hung out.
Mostly worldwide famous?
There? I don't know. clearly, I'm inspired by the sea and nature, which form the basis of so much of what I do. All of my artwork is cheerful, but sometimes I start pieces off with a sad thought or memory. Then I work through my feelings in creating art. I find it very therapeutic. I hope people who come to see the exhibition can find something in my work, a connection, a spark, a memory. So, yeah, sitting on her paddle board. And that's what she does. She just sits across legged with her paints and whatnot and paints pictures.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty cool. And it's always changing. There's always something new. Whether it's the ocean with a boat or just the ocean or the piers or the coastline, birds, people. It's pretty cool. Pretty cool to do that. Did you Google Freddy the Dolphin?
Yeah, I can't read what I found.
Uh-oh.
Did you see my face?
Maybe put your glasses on?
No. Well, yeah, but there's lots of stories here. But, yeah. I'm not going to read this thing.
Google Freddy the Dolphin and find out who he was.
Ignore the article from The Guardian.
Oh. May 7th, which is pass, the Royal Rafting officially began. A voyage with replicas of traditional boats from Krakow to Gdansk. The first Krakow section is accompanied by a 4-day celebration co-organized by the Museum of Krakow. This year's Royal Rafting set off for the 19th time from the mouth of the Przemysl River. This place marks the beginning of the navigable Vistula, the 0 kilometer of the 941.3-kilometer waterway route to Gdansk. It is here that the rafters gathered to ceremonially begin their journey, drifting with Galar boats to Tyniec. Galar boats are a old form of, it's almost like log rafts that they would use, but they're long ones. So picture a regular log raft, you think, but picture like 4 or 5 of them attached together, and there's like straw huts on them, and that's what they use to haul stuff up and down.
Started to sound similar to or familiar with the Japanese one where there's all these logs.
The Kitayama Gorge?
Yes, the Kitayama Gorge with the log
snakes.
Can't
wait till August.
Are you going to do that run?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we put it in our timeline.
Excellent.
excuse me. Participants spent time finalizing their preparations for the journey, fine-tuning technical details, and decorating the boats, most of which are replicas of 18th century galars, Polish flat-bottom rowing vessels. The first Royal Rafting was organized in 2006. Its creator and main organizer is skipper Yaroslav Kaluza. Flag fluttering above the boats bears the image of King Casimir the Great. The event is always held in May, lasts about 3 weeks. Participants spend nights on islands along the way, warmly welcomed by the residents of the Vistula's shores with refreshments. The final docking takes place in front of the bow of the museum ship SS Soldek. Whole event aims to raise awareness among Poles about their history and tradition of transporting goods down the Vistula. Yeah, so it's like exactly the same thing as getting your goods down, and that's you know what it is. It is worth recalling that rafting was inscribed in the National List of Intangible Cultural Heritage in 2014, and in 2022, it became the fifth Polish tradition included in UNESCO's representative list of that intangible cultural heritage of humanity. Participants of the rafting cite the decree of King John I Albert from 1496 as the legal basis for the voyage. We have decided that navigation on the rivers of our kingdom, upstream and downstream, with all kinds of goods, shall be free for all people of any status, prohibiting any obstacles and customs duties. So basically, they're saying in 1496 that anybody could go up and down the river and not be charged a duty or obstructed in any way. It was a free road.
Yeah.
As early as the 16th century, rafting navigation in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth was highly developed. Flat-bottom boats called galars, boiki, and komiengas transported goods such as grain, coal, and salt along the Vistula. Additionally, rafters floated timber using rafts tied from individual logs. Only in the 19th century did berlinkas, a more technologically advanced decked vessel powered by sails, appear on the Vistula. This marked the end of the traditional rafting area, which the participants of the Royal Rafting aimed to recall and revive.
Hmm.
So, you know, you get all these people that like to do the, I don't want to say cosplay. What's the
Oh, yeah. They do it with the medieval...
Those, or they get the armies, and they go out and show how they...
Reenactments.
Reenactments. You get all the people that are doing that, reenacting bits of history and stuff.
Yeah,
and these are
cosplay is not the word to use.
Cosplay was not the word. That's the first word that came in my... So all these people get out there cosplay historical moments. I don't know who's cosplaying Washington crossing the Delaware, but you got that spot on, buddy. Yes, reenactments. But these are basically people doing the same thing. They're just reenacting with how things used to go. Historical rafting and going up in traditional transportation, that sort of stuff. And they're trying to bring it back and show people, remember, you know, here's how we used to do it. Yeah. Don't forget our history, which is kind of cool. So yeah, that goes on for 3 weeks. Time of getting time off. But there's big parties, like 3-day party beforehand, and then they all launch.
This is a short party.
3 days? Maybe. Sorry, I lied. 4-day party.
Oh.
That sounds better. It's a 4-day party before they launch. You used to live out east, or out west, or out east and out west.
Yeah, I was on both coasts.
Out of Vancouver, wellness specialist Victoria Williams says Deep Cove is a really magical spot with lots of wildlife. It's her favorite place to unwind. You simply head to the waterfront station, hop on the sea bus. Passenger ferry will take you across to the harbor on Longsdale Quay, where you'll switch to a regular bus. Your destination is Deep Cove, tiny village at the foot of Mount Seymour, facing out into Indian Arm, a branch of the Burrard Inlet. Known as the Cove by locals, the harbor community offers plenty of ways to relax and enjoy Vancouver's extraordinary beauty. She says, I love to go after work to go for a paddleboard, especially in the summer when you know it's not getting dark until 8:30, 9 o'clock. Usually you'll see tons of folks down by the water enjoying the sunset, maybe bringing some dinner with them. It's a beautiful spot on a summer evening. Have you ever been to, did you ever paddle in Deep Cove when you were
out
there?
I never have, no. I only paddled around the island, the Vancouver Island itself.
Okay.
Victoria Harbor. And
Deep Cove is best known for its Baden-Powell Trail, which traverses Horseshoe Bay, popular and shorter way to enjoy the trail. Is to hike about 2.5 miles up to Quarry Rock. From this lookout point, hikers can view Burrard Inlet and the village of Belcarra across the river, then the take just double back the same way you came down to the village. So you could go paddling and hiking.
Yes, exactly. Yep.
After the hike, William suggests a reward. Pop into Honey Donuts and Goodies. Why would you go anywhere else? What's the point of going if you're not going for donuts? Donuts are worth the wait in line. For a more of a meal, she recommends getting a table at the Arms Reach Bistro. Everywhere you look, she says, you'll see evidence of the waterfront location. If you're inclined to go from looking at the water to paddling in it, rent a paddleboard or a kayak, you may be treated by a visitor from some water-based locals. Go out for an hour or two and you're likely to see some seals or a whale if you're lucky. Usually there are eagles flying above and jellyfish. It's a really magical spot with lots of wildlife.
There's so much to see on the water out in British Columbia.
Right.
Like the coastal communities are just amazing. And like I only barely got to touch the surface of it when I used to live out there. Just wasn't enough time to do it all. But I recall back in the day, it was like you basically could like go downhill skiing in the morning and head down to the coast in the afternoon, do a little bit of kayaking and then maybe a little hike. And so it was, mm-hmm. you had it all, right? Like there's,
it's definitely an outdoor person's dream out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, even still, my brother was looking at all these things and, cause he's big into the fishing. So he's like, hey, we ought to go do a fishing trip out there. And you know, some of the trips here, there's paddling involved and almost every trip that they try to sell you,
mm-hmm.
involves the chances of seeing seals and whales and wolves and this and that. Like there's so much, they make it sound like it's just teeming
it's not.
With wildlife.
Yeah.
But still to get out there and see like an,
anything.
Like
just a
sea otter
or
a seal swim by or something like that is pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, when we went up to Moosonee, we're sitting there and all of a sudden bloop, bloop, some seals pop up and whatnot, and that's just like, that's cool. Because, you know, it's not something that you usually see. So
it is amazing.
So if you're out on the west coast of Canada and you're in the Vancouver area, take a peek at Deep Cove, and if you get the chance, you might want to go do a little paddle there. It sounds like it should be a pretty cool place. The pictures are pretty astonishing anyway. So I came across this one, a little piece of gear. I'm not going to go really whole hog into details with it. It's the Skyview Backpacker Tent. Experience the magic of the cosmos like never before with the Skyview Backpacker, the best stargazing backpacking tent on the market. Colorado-built tents are perfect for backcountry adventurers, astrophotographers, and campers who love gazing at the stars. Skyview Backpacker is a two-person, three-season tent built for all-night stargazing, quick setup, durability, lightweight for the longest backcountry hikes to beautiful vistas and skies free from light pollution. So basically this thing is, you remember the original triangle pup tents?
Typical pup tent, yeah.
Picture one of those with fancy poles, lightweight poles, made totally of screen.
Exactly.
Where you lay down your sleeping bag and you have a complete
full view of the sky.
Of the sky.
So it'll be slightly, they are proud of their mesh that they've used in the design. So you can see clearly, obviously there's going to be a little bit of obscuring the view, but it's like mostly you can see right through it. It looks like a really neat design. You're just laying under the stars. And I don't know how many times I've just gone to bed and it's like, I should leave the fly off so I can watch the stars as I doze off to sleep. But then I always thought, oh, I don't want to be woken up and have to get out of my tent, run around outside, whip the fly back onto it.
So one of the selling points when I bought my Eureka Spitfire was the fact that it was all mesh.
Yeah.
And it was just a quick snap on the fly, right? So if I left half the fly, like it let you keep the top half of the fly off, so you could do that.
Yeah.
You could stare at the, and then if it started to rain, yeah, you had to get up, you just grabbed one clip, you pulled it over the top and clipped it in.
Yeah.
Easy peasy. You're good to go. And I'm thinking, well, that's cool, but then you got to get out.
Out of your sleeping bag and run outside, get some shoes on.
So the thing about this Skyview tent is you're thinking, okay, well, then you got to get out and still put it on. Like, all these tents are made of mesh these days.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Like, so what's a whoop-de-doodly-da about yours? The walls, the fly, is on the inside.
And it's pretty neat.
It's pretty neat. So basically, you have this tub bottom, and then the mesh sides come down, but they're sewn in about halfway down
into pocket.
The side of the if the side of this tub that you're is the that's the bottom of the tent is 10 inches.
Yeah.
The mesh is sewn in about 5 inches down, leaving this
sleeve
sort
pocket.
Of thing.
Yeah.
Well, then bunched on the inside of the tent with the bottom of these curtains, which is the fly, is inside that flap. So you just pull it across like you'd be pulling a curtain across.
Yeah, like you're closing blinds. Like if there's a blind or a curtain behind your couch, the bottom part of the blind fits in behind the couch, and the rain will hit the fly, run into the behind part, and just drain off.
Yeah, it doesn't go front of that into your tent at all.
You don't
really even have cool design.
You don't even have to get out of your sleeping bag.
You don't have to. You just need to pull this thing straight across. Yep. Make sure it goes straight across, and you're good to go.
It's a neat design.
It really is. They do have two of them. The backpacker, 4.6 pounds packaged weight, includes pole, stakes, carry bags, guy wires, etc. 3.25 pounds packaged weight in a trekking pole mode. So for anybody backpacking, if they don't want to bring all the poles, there is an attachment that you can use your trekking poles instead. It is 52 inches by 80 inches and 42 inches tall. Pfeiffer UltraView R2 polyester. Fabric is a 3D tear-resistant nylon waterproof. Poles are 10.2 millimeter OD aluminum for the grand total of $494 U.S.
Which is a lot.
It is a lot, but...
But it is a decent three-season tent, and you can get the two-person... Well, the three-person is
so,
a bit more.
Yeah, there is the Skyview XL stargazing tent. 11.75 pounds.
Yeah, it's getting up there.
90 by 90 by 55 inches tall. Again, the Pfeiffer UltraView 2 polyester mesh. The fabric is 210D Oxford with waterproof, and the pole is 3/4 inch OD aluminum. $565 US.
What state is AL? Alabama, Alaska,
Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Yeah. So $565 for that one. So, like I say, expensive, yeah. Would I want to carry around a 12-pound tent? No. I think most people would probably go for the
two-man?
The backpacker one where you could use your poles, your trekking poles, instead of all the extra poles. And like I say, the selling point for this would be that the walls of the tent are inside.
Yes.
That you can just pull them straight across like curtains.
I love that idea.
So if you go to skyviewtents.com, on the main page, if you scroll down, there's two videos. Click the one on the left, and it'll show you the tent, and there's a guy inside that actually... He shows you how he pulls it straight across, so if it starts raining, you'll stay dry. really cool design, whoever did this. Because, yeah, like you say, there's days where you're sitting in the tent thinking, it's really nice out, and be nice to be able to look at the stars. It's yeah. a full moon, the star or the Milky Way's right above us, or the northern lights are out. I'd love to be sitting here falling asleep under the northern lights, you know, and the bears can see you better.
You can see the bears
coming. You can see the bears coming, quickly draw the curtains. Skyviewtents.com. Go check them out. There's the backpacker and there's the XL stargazing tents. Cool design. Got to say, will I get one? Probably not.
Mm-hmm.
But hey, if you're in places that are wide open and you got such a
some people huge, love living out in the or sleeping yeah. out in the open.
Well,
so
it keeps the bugs off too. It's like sleeping in a bug tent.
Exactly. So right? you got some mesh. You got
I gotta think the bugs off. They'll probably sell a lot of these. I would think.
I think so.
Yeah. So. All righty. And that, I think, is all I've got this week.
Nailed it.
Nailed it. Are you going to send West a message about accepting you for this one?
I'd have to ask at work if I could get the time off.
Get the time off, yeah.
Pre-prepare. That's what stimmed me before. Well, I didn't make the grade last time for the 2023 expedition. And so I did ask him a few times, hey, I'm interested. But
oh, God, not that guy again. We can't lose you from the podcast, Eric.
You could replace me in a heartbeat.
Is my dog still here? all right. You got anything else?
I do not.
Heard something funny today.
Did you?
Yeah, it's a parting. Ha, 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 ha. Couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
No.
You ever, I don't know what your wife is like, but I know Tracy knows when I need to go out for the day paddling or something or going on a trip. And she'll say, you know what, dude? Go out for a paddle, go for an overnighter, whatever, get out of the house, go. Well, apparently, Kevin Callen.
Oh, yes.
Christine told him, you know what?
Just go
for a day. You're getting grumpy, stressful.
Go fishing.
Yeah. So he decided he would go out and check out a spot, and I guess him and Angel went.
It was a comedy of errors.
And it was a comedy. If anything could go wrong, it went wrong. He went to check out a spot, came back, and his car was locked, and he didn't have his keys. So he had to backtrack. He finally found his keys. He did the tick check, and he found on the dog, and he found one on his arm.
One on his neck, on the back of his knee.
Yeah, and one in a place you never want a tick to be.
I don't know if it was on the right or left grape, but
it was there. I don't want to know any further than that. Anything that could go wrong, and it did. But it's like, oh.
He said it bled a lot when he pulled that tick.
Yeah.
There's a lot of blood flow to that area.
Yeah, apparently. Isn't that the curse? May the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your nether regions.
Yeah.
yeah. Some days, you know what? You need to get away. And some days, even though you need to get away, don't. Because it's just going to get worse. It's all downhill from there. Anyway, that's all I've got this week. That's all you've got this
week. That's all I got.
So if you want to find out more about us, you can find us at paddlingadventuresradio.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You can download or stream our episodes on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Player FM, and all your favorite podcast downloading sites. Or you can just go to the episode page at paddlingadventuresradio.com, and you can stream or download all our episodes there. If you enjoyed the podcast, please share it with friends, family, and fellow paddlers. I want to thank everybody for listening this week. I'm Sean Rowley.
And I'm Derek Specht. We'll see you next time.